Chapter 2. All go on doing Plymouth and Salem. So stupid. My cousin's house, now, is remarkable. This place must have had a past. It must have been more of a place once. He stopped short, with the blush of a shy man who overhears himself, and fears he has been voluble. I'm an architect, you see, and I'm hunting up old houses in these parts. She stared. LD houses? Everything's old in North Dormer, isn't it? The folks are, anyhow. He laughed, and wandered away again. Haven't you any kind of a history of the place? I think there was one written about 1840. A book or pamphlet about its first settlement, he presently said from the farther end of the room. She pressed her crotchet hook against her lip and pondered. There was such a work, she knew. North Dormer and the early townships of Eagle County. She had a special grudge against it, because it was a limp weekly book that was always either falling off the shelf or slipping back and disappearing, if one squeezed it in between sustaining volumes. She remembered, the last time S.E. had picked it up, wondering how anyone could have taken the trouble to write a book about North Dormer and its neighbors. Dormer, Hamblin, Creston, and Creston River. She knew them all, mere lost clusters of houses in the folds of the desolate ridges. Dormer, where North Dormer went for its apples, Creston River, where there used to be a paper mill, and its gray walls stood decaying by the stream, and Hamblin, where the first snow always fell. Such were their titles to fame. She got up, and began to move about vaguely before the shelves. But S.E. had no idea where S.E. had last put the book, and something told her that it was going to play her its usual trick and remain invisible. It was not one of her lucky days. I guess it's somewhere, she said, to prove her zeal, but she spoke without conviction, and felt that her words conveyed none. Oh, well, he said again. She knew he was going, and wished more than ever to find the book. It will be for next time, he added, and picking up the volume he had laid on the desk he handed it to her. By the way, a little air and sun would do this good. It's rather valuable. He gave her a nod and smile, and passed out. 2. The hours of the Hatchard Memorial Librarian were from 3 to 5, and Charity Royal's sense of duty usually kept her at her desk until nearly half past 4. But as he had never perceived that any practical advantage thereby accrued either to North Dormer or to herself, and as he had no scruple in decreeing, when it suited her, that the library should close an hour earlier. A few minutes after Mr. Harney's departure she formed this decision, put away her lace, fastened the shutters, and turned the key in the door of the Temple of Knowledge. The street upon which she emerged was still empty. And after glancing up and down it, she began to walk toward her house. But instead of entering she passed on, turned into a field path, and mounted to a pasture on the hillside. She let down the bars of the gate, followed a trail along the crumbling wall of the pasture, and walked until she reached a knoll, where a clump of larches shook out their fresh tassels to the wind. There she lay down on the slope, tossed off her hat, and hid her face in the grass. She was blind and insensible to many things, and dimly knew it, but to all that was light and air, perfume, and color, every drop of blood in her responded. She loved the roughness of the dry mountain grass under her palms, the smell of the thyme into which she crushed her face, the fingering of the wind in her hair, and through her cotton blouse, and the creak of the larches as they swayed to it. She often climbed up the hill, and lay there alone for the mere pleasure of feeling the wind, and of rubbing her cheeks in the grass. Generally at such times she did not think of anything, but lay immersed in an inarticulate well-being. Today the sense of well-being was intensified by her joy at escaping from the library. She liked well enough to have a friend drop in and talk to her when she was on duty, but she hated to be bothered about books. How could she remember where they were, when they were so seldom asked for? Orma Fry occasionally took out a novel, and her brother Ben was fond of what he called ography, and of books relating to trade and bookkeeping, But no one else asked for anything except, at intervals, Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Peening of a Chestnut Burr, or Longfellow. As he had these under her hand, and could have found them in the dark, but unexpected demands came so rarely that they exasperated her like an injustice. As he had liked the young man's looks, and his short-sighted eyes, and his odd way of speaking, that was abrupt yet soft, just as his hands were sunburnt and sinewy, yet with smooth nails like a woman's. His hair was sunburnt looking too, or rather the color of bracken after frost, his eyes gray, with the appealing look of the short-sighted, his smile shy yet confident, as if he knew lots of things as he had never dreamed of, and yet wouldn't for the world have had her feel his superiority. But she did feel it, and liked the feeling, for it was new to her. Poor and ignorant as she was, and knew herself to be humblest of the humble even in North Dormer, where to come from the mountain was the worst disgrace yet in her narrow world as he had always ruled. It was partly, of course, owing to the fact that Lawyer Royal was the biggest man in North Dormer, so much too big for it, in fact, that outsiders, who didn't know, always wondered how it held him. In spite of everything and in spite even of Miss Hatchard, Lawyer Royal ruled in North Dormer, and Charity ruled in Lawyer Royal's house. As he had never put it to herself in those terms, but she knew her power, knew what it was made of, and hated it. Confusedly, the young man in the library had made her feel for the first time what might be the sweetness of dependence. She sat up, brushed the bits of grass from her hair, and looked down on the house where she held sway. It stood just below her, cheerless and untended, its faded red front divided from the road by a yard with a path bordered by gooseberry bushes, a stone well overgrown with traveler's joy, and a sickly crimson rambler tied to a fan-shaped support, which Mr. Royal had once brought up from Hepburn to please her. Behind the house a bit of uneven ground with clothesline strung across it stretched up to a dry wall, and beyond the wall a patch of corn, and a few rows of potatoes strayed vaguely into the adjoining wilderness of rock and fern. Charity could not recall her first sight of the house. As he had been told, that she was ill of a fever when she was brought down from the mountain, and she could only remember waking one day in a cot at the foot of Mrs. Royal's bed, and opening her eyes on the cold neatness of the room that was afterward to be hers. Mrs. Royal died 7 or 8 years later, and by that time Charity had taken the measure of most things about her. She knew that Mrs. Royal was sad, and timid and weak. She knew that Lawyer Royal was harsh and violent, and still weaker. She knew that as he had been christened Charity in the white church at the other end of the village, to commemorate Mr. Royal's disinterestedness in bringing her down, and to keep alive in her a becoming sense of her dependence. She knew that Mr. Royal was her guardian, but that he had not legally adopted her, though everybody spoke of her as Charity Royal, and she knew why he had come back, to live at North Dormer, instead of practicing at Nettleton, where he had begun his legal career. After Mrs. Royal's death there was some talk of sending her to a boarding school. Miss Hatchard suggested it, and had a long conference with Mr. Royal, who, in pursuance of her plan, departed one day for Starkfield, to visit the institution she recommended. He came back the next night with a black face, worse, Charity observed, than as he had ever seen him, and by that time as he had had some experience. When she asked him how soon she was to start, he answered shortly, "You ain't going," and shut himself up in the room he called his office. And the next day the lady who kept the school at Starkfield wrote that under the circumstances she was afraid she could not make room just then for another pupil. Charity was disappointed, but she understood. It wasn't the temptations of Starkfield that had been Mr. Royal's undoing, it was the thought of losing her. He was a dreadfully onesome man, as he had made that out, because she was so onesome herself. He and she, face to face in that sad house, had sounded the depths of isolation, and though she felt no particular affection for him, and not the slightest gratitude, She pitied him, because she was conscious that he was superior to the people about him, and that she was the only being between him and solitude. Therefore, when Miss Hatchard sent for her a day or two later, to talk of a school at Nettleton, and to say that this time a friend of hers would make the necessary arrangements, Charity cut her short with the announcement that she had decided not to leave North Dormer. Miss Hatchard reasoned with her kindly, but to no purpose. She simply repeated, "Guess Mr. Royal's too lonesome." Miss Hatchard blinked perplexedly behind her eyeglasses. Her long, frail face was full of puzzled wrinkles, and she leant forward, resting her hands on the arms of her mahogany armchair, with the evident desire to say something that ought to be said. "The feeling does you credit, my dear." She looked about the pale walls of her sitting room, seeking counsel of ancestral daguerreotypes and didactic samplers, but they seemed to make utterance more difficult. "The fact is, it's not only because of the advantages. There are other reasons. You're too young to understand." "Oh, no, I ain't," said Charity harshly, and Miss Hatchard blushed to the roots of her blonde cap. But she must have felt a vague relief at having her explanation cut short, for she concluded, again invoking the daguerreotypes, "Of course I shall always do what I can for you, and in case, you know you can always come to me." Lawyer Royal was waiting for Charity in the porch when she returned from this visit. He had shaved and brushed his black coat and looked a magnificent monument of a man. At such moments she really admired him. "Well," he said, "is it settled?" "Yes, it's settled. I ain't going." "Not to the Nettleton school?" "Not anywhere." He cleared his throat and asked sternly, "Hi?" "I'd rather not," she said, swinging past him on her way to her room. It was the following week that he brought her up the Crimson Rambler and its fan from Hepburn. He had never given her anything before. The next outstanding incident of her life had happened 2 years later, when she was 17. Lawyer Royal, who hated to go to Nettleton, had been called there in connection with a case. He still exercised his profession, though litigation languished in North Dormer and its outlying hamlets, and for once he had had an opportunity that he could not afford to refuse. He spent 3 days in Nettleton, won his case, and came back in high good humor. It was a rare mood with him, and manifested itself on this occasion by his talking impressively at the supper table of the rousing welcome his old friends had given him. He wound up confidentially, "Was a damn fool ever to leave Nettleton. It was Mrs. Royal that made me do it." Charity immediately perceived that something bitter had happened to him, and that he was trying to talk down the recollection. She went up to bed early, leaving him seated in moody thought, his elbows propped on the worn oilcloth of the supper table. On the way up she had extracted from his overcoat pocket the key of the cupboard, where the bottle of whiskey was kept. She was awakened by a rattling at her door and jumped out of bed. She heard Mr. Royal's voice, low and peremptory, and opened the door, fearing an accident. No other thought had occurred to her, but when she saw him in the doorway, a ray from the autumn moon falling on his discomposed face, she understood. For a moment they looked at each other in silence, then, as he put his foot across the threshold, she stretched out her arm and stopped him. "You go right back from here," she said, in a shrill voice that startled her. "You ain't going to have that key tonight." "Charity, let me in. I don't want the key. I'm a lonesome man," he began, in the deep voice that sometimes moved her. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.